Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. We are starting with a new book, so we're super excited to dig into this thing and start to tear it apart and get all we can out of it. The we that I'm talking about is I am joined by the always amazing JP, who is a developer at Open Listings. And my name is John, by the way, and I am a Rails developer and kind of quasi do a lot of code, I guess you could say. How are you doing today, JP? And did I introduce you okay? I've never really introduced us like that. Feels different.
Yeah, that was kind of just off the cuff. I guess technically I work at Open Door now, but it's kind of the same thing. It's one of those
I missed that. Damn it.
It's like one of those square rectangle things, you know, like all rectangles are are squares, but not all squares are rectangles. That's okay. So what book are we going through again this week? Remind me the full title.
Oh, yeah. So this is a new season, technically, because we're starting a new book. And the book that we are starting to get into here is Refactoring, Improving the Design of Existing Code by Martin Fowler, in parentheses, with Kent Beck. So this is actually a super famous and popular tome. It's one I've been wanting to get into for a long time, but I have really kind of avoided it because all the previous examples were all in Java. Not that there's anything wrong with Java, but it's not directly applicable to the work that I do, and it's not a language that I work in. So I kind of avoided the book because it felt a bit antiquated. The book hadn't been updated in a while, but it's perfect timing because this second edition just came out, like just as in like 2019, just in this year, or just late 2018. And the entire book has been rewritten, all the examples in JavaScript, which is very applicable to me, especially because JavaScript is the weaker of the languages that I write on a day-to-day basis. And even just from chapter one, I've already gained so many great insights to refactoring in general, but specifically for JavaScript as well, which is really exciting.
Yeah. And so JavaScript is not technically like an object-oriented language in the sense that though it does have classes, the way that you do inheritance kind of looks like classical inheritance, although I think under the hood what's really happening is like prototypal inheritance. That's neither here nor there, but what I'm trying to say ultimately is that this book is a great read for anyone who is trying to up their game in object-oriented design. So though it is written in JavaScript, if you're like a Ruby developer or a PHP developer or Python developer or developing anything that has to do with OO design, I feel like this is a good read.
Yeah. And the author starts to specify in the introduction that it's you don't have to know JavaScript. All these examples aren't only applicable to JavaScript. We're going to walk through a lot of different concepts about refactoring at a high level. And then the goal is to dig into some specific approaches and specific refactors. So here is a type of refactor you can do and how that breaks down. And we'll do our best to keep it broad and applicable to any language and domain. But you know, the examples are in JavaScript, but you can't really talk through code anyway. So let's talk about kind of the introduction, what this book is, how we're going to be breaking it down, which is a bit unique for our podcast. So the first thing is, what's in this book? It's all a guide to refactoring. So Martin Fowler starts talking about what refactoring is a little bit. It's the process of changing software in a way that does not alter the external behavior of the code, yet improves its internal structure. So it's about the same inputs and outputs, but the processing of that information between those two chains is just cleaned up, easier to maintain, and ultimately it's more stable, easier to maintain. It's a lot of the things that we've been talking about across this entire year and a half of doing this podcast, which is just keeping your code fluid and flexible and supple. That's always the word that we come back to. And so it's interesting because the book, the first four chapters is all concepts at a high level about how refactoring works, when to do it, some of the processes within refactoring. And then the rest of the entire book, which is probably 60% of the book or so, is actually just specific refactors broken down. So he actually has, in the very beginning of this book, it's made to be kind of a reference guide to just sit up on the shelf and you're like, oh, what was that refactor I can use in this case? So there's this list of probably a couple dozen refactors, maybe 30, 45 refactors, things like extract class, extract function, inline function, all these different names of specific refactors. So the way that we've decided to dig into this book is to walk through these four chapters, which are high-level concepts, alternating with a whole episode of specific refactors. So today we're going to talk a high level about refactoring, the refactoring process, some of the takeaways about refactoring at a high level. And then next week, we're actually going to get deep into specific code examples that are, you can implement them that day. So hopefully you can listen this on your way to work, and by the time you get there, you have a couple refactors in your head that you can try in your code that day. So that's the way that we're going to be breaking this down. So 1 week is high level, the next week is nitty gritty and digging into it kind of back and forth until we get through the content of this book to try to get all the best pieces and nuggets just encapsulated into a hopefully not horribly boring way for you.
Yeah, so you will definitely know if the podcast episode that you're listening to is code intensive. We wanted to sort of segment how we discuss this in more digestible ways. And I think that would definitely not be easy to listen to if we're both talking about high level things and also code examples in the same podcast. So yeah, there's that. The book does start off going through like a heavy refactoring of a really long function, but we won't get into that until next episode.
Yeah, totally. So beyond, you know, what's in the book and how we're going to approach it, let's talk about what he starts getting into. And so I feel like through this example, he introduces this big, long, very technical example and then slowly refactors it through. But what we can see at a high level is his general approach for how to refactor, where he starts, what he does first, what he then does, and then what kind of the end goal is he's working towards. So the first thing he talks about when looking at a piece of code is identifying the pain, like smelling the smell, knowing that something needs a refactor. And he touched on briefly this idea of just pre-optimization and refactoring just for the sake of refactoring, because ultimately you can always find a way to continuously improve code. And at some point you have to call done done and find the right point of technical debt versus functionality. And you have to be pragmatic about this. You know, not all code is always going to be 100% eloquent and 100% perfect, and that's not what it should be. So we shouldn't think that because we're doing this big 6-episode or 8-episode arc on refactoring that no matter what, all code you ship every single day has to look perfect and be refactored to the nth-most degree no matter what. Ultimately, we want to be pragmatic about this, and we want to find the right balance between technical debt, shipping products, and finding that right balance between refactoring. So in your day-to-day, JP, like how much do you look at code and refactoring as something that must happen before something ships versus something that's kind of an ongoing process? How do you find the balance between being pragmatic about refactoring and shipping code and having beautiful code, you know, in every PR you submit?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure if it was in the first chapter or in a subsequent chapter, but I believe he talks about this idea. He tries to dispel this notion that refactoring has to be this huge, gigantic thing. And I think in the past, that is something that I've approached. Like, that's the way that I've approached refactoring.
For sure.
One example I can think of is like the first iteration of WizTutor that we made with React Native was like total garbage, because that was like the first thing I ever made. And that was like in 2017 or something like that, 2 years ago. And then when we had to add new features, I was like, oh crap, before I could even like work on this really, I have to like refactor the whole thing. And that refactor itself took like a month. That was crazy.
Longer than the feature addition after the refactor was done.
Yeah, totally.
Which is a good sign, actually, to some degree, that the new feature additions were easier after the refactor.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it was a necessary evil, but like maybe the approach was should not have been like, oh, we should totally just like basically rewrite the whole app. Maybe the approach, now looking back at it, was we should add this feature, ship it, and then like make slow improvements into the code base. But to answer your original question of like what does refactoring look like on a day-to-day basis for me, I think in many ways you're always refactoring. Maybe it's moving a variable into a method, like a getter method or something like that. Or maybe it's simply just renaming a variable so that it's like way more clear what it does. So yeah, I think this idea that like you actually are always constantly refactoring is kind of the outlook that I see it now, and not just like, oh, subjectively, I think this code looks ugly, I need to change it. Or, oh, I need to improve the performance of this code. So I'm going to do X, Y, and Z things. While those things are technically refactoring, I like to think of refactoring as just like these little minor improvements that we're always, always making and you should be making.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because I almost think of it like a crash diet. Like if you want to be healthy, you can every quarter like do this insane 3-week diet every 4 months and like lose the 10 pounds you gained and go to the gym insane for 3 weeks, like every 4 months. And like, yeah, you might look pretty good and kind of be generally healthy, but you haven't like adapted a lifestyle of good exercise and eating. Like really being healthy and eating well is something you do every day when you sit down to eat a meal. And it's in small pieces and it's more of a lifestyle than it is something you just like dig into and crash every once in a while to like lose the weight that you've gained in the last year. And I almost feel like that's how refactoring should be. It should be more like a lifestyle and just a way of life and the way that you code. And every time you sit down to code, it's just those little decisions every day versus these like big, intensive, ridiculous digging in for 3 weeks and refactoring the whole code base. I think there is a time and a place for those, especially when you're talking about a startup, or let's say you started a project at a hackathon just to get it live for a demo, and then you want to turn it into a real product. You should probably take a week or two and just refactor that code and clean it up because you wrote it at 2 a.m. with Red Bull and vodka. So like, there's time and a place for getting those refactors and focusing on just that refactor. But I think in general, he gives the example of the camping rule, which is I think is from the Boy Scouts, which is leave things better than you found them and just do that every time you touch the code. And so every time you're in doing any kind of update, like break out some methods, you leave it better than you found it that first time. So I think it's important, and I totally agree with you that it's small regular changes. And so when to refactor is really just a process of just always, you should always kind of be refactoring. I will say one quick thing about that big refactor, if it's needed, like the one you had to do for WizTutor, or let's say, you know, post a hackathon, that type of refactor. I think it's really important to not try to do new features while you're doing a refactor. I've made this mistake so many times. It's like, oh, I'm going to ship feature XYZ and also do refactor ABC at the same time. It should not be the process. You should start with refactor ABC and then ship feature XYZ, or even flip those. It doesn't really matter, but you should not try to do them at the same time. You'll create so much more pain than is necessary. You need to treat them as two separate deliverables, two separate pull requests, and not try to refactor while shipping a feature. Do one before the other. It doesn't really matter what order. I'd probably recommend the refactor first and then the new feature, but that's totally up to you and depending on what the business needs are at the time.
Yeah, I think in the same vein, another mistake that's like sort of congruent that I made, that we made with shipping a new version of WizTutor, that we like totally decided to redesign it. And that ended up making the refactor take way, way, way longer than it needed to be. it was like a couple months of just not only updating the way that the navigation worked, but also just like going through this redesign. And we also wanted to address some new features that, you know, we had discovered we needed because of like user testing, or like people were complaining to Justin about like, hey, this isn't working that well.
And so it was this perfect storm of all three things. It was a refactor, a redesign, and new features on top of that. And definitely all three of those should be separate deliverables. Like refactor first, new feature, and then a redesign at the very end, probably. And honestly, that'll help you try to keep your tests written in a way that separates your front end logic and some of those other things. Like those things don't need to be so tightly coupled. Those should be their own deliverables, and it's gonna help you write better things. So, all right, let's jump to the next process. So that's really the first step, is knowing when to refactor, which I know we're going to cover more in future episodes walking through this whole refactoring thing. So what's the next step? I know that I need a refactor. I've got the time set aside. I've got the open issue of the refactoring that needs to be done. What's the next step? The next step that he recommends is test coverage first. So that's the next step he recommends. And what would you do though, JP, if you have a code base that isn't quite test covered yet, like you don't have the coverage and you're still wanting to refactor? Would you stop and write tests? What would you do in that case?
Yeah, that's really hard because you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. Right. But the best thing I think you could do is write a couple of like core functionality tests. So you should have some expectations about what a feature should do. And I think you should write all the tests that cover the base cases. And who knows, maybe you'll unearth some edge cases, But you probably should go into that knowing that you're not going to cover everything. Otherwise, you're probably going to lose your mind. But you should definitely write a couple of like functionality tests so that like you can make assertions on what you think should happen. Just so that when you're like refactoring, it's like, okay, the tests say that they're doing this. I changed some code. The tests are still passing. So I can at least be confident that some features are working the way that I expect them to. Now, who knows, maybe those might be false positives or false negatives, but I feel like that is way, way better than going into it completely blind and just like going through the minutia of like clicking around and checking things right. Very manually, you know? But yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, again and again. And because what I've found is that friction of having to QA things, quality check things yourself manually, makes it so you don't want to make more refactors. Because it's like, oh, I just checked it. I know it's good. I don't want to touch that house of cards because I'm afraid it'll all fall down again. And it really makes it so that you're not excited to dig into tests and excited to make your code more eloquent because you have to sit and re-QA it again. And so, yes, testing is an investment and testing can be a pain in the ass and it can feel like it's not important. But it's either you write tests up front and make that very small investment at minimum to that golden path, get to that 40-50% test coverage or that 60% test coverage on just what you're trying to refactor at that point. You know, ideally you can get to that point because otherwise you're going to make an exponential investment on the back end, having to QA this thing over and over and over and over again, running it in every simulator and just having to do that again and again, or you're going to pay an even higher price when it comes out the back end and your users and or client are frustrated by an app that's just straight up not working and it's buggy as hell. And I almost see it as this way of an investment. You have to pay the price either way. And depending on where your priorities are, either you pay the price in test coverage up front, or you pay it in QA before it ships, or you pay it in bugs when it does deliver. And I feel like each of those price tags gets exponentially more expensive through the process. So the earlier you can make that investment, the better, and it's just cheaper for you. Like in a way, it's $20 to write the tests up front, $100 to the QA on the back end, or $1,000 to have to do it when it actually delivers to your client. And if you think about it this way, yes, it is expensive, and yes, it is a frustrating tax to have to pay this test coverage up front, but it's way cheaper to make that investment up front than it is to try to do that on the back end. And when it comes to refactoring, the confidence of having green, having red, having green again, when running your tests and running the tests, making a change and running the test, which really leads us into the next step of what refactoring is. So once you know you need a refactor in your code, so you've identified that you do want to refactor something, once you have the test coverage, the next step is small changes and continually running tests. He had this mantra through it that was like, change, compile, test, commit, again and again and again. And it was interesting because as he walked through this example, which we'll walk through next episode more, he literally changes one method, runs the tests, compiles, commits it. And he even like shows like, okay, and then I committed the code. And it was like, you may change one line, dude. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's something to say about, he makes a small note about how your test suite should be, it should tell you exactly like what's passing, the output of when you run your tests should be very informative of telling you exactly what's passing, what's failing, maybe how many tests have passed. And I feel like this might be a remnant of the older times when test suites weren't as robust as they are now. But like in today, there's like really no excuse to not have something like this. And for Opendoor, we use like coveralls. And coveralls is really cool because once you like commit your code to GitHub, it will tell you like the percent of test coverage you have based on like whatever folder settings you decide to like ask how, like what percentage of coverage is like in these directories. And not only that, it will like go in the files and it will tell you like what percentage of those files are being hit. So like, let's say you have an if else statement, but you're only testing the if case, it will highlight the else part of that and tell you like, oh, hey, by the way, none of your tests reached this else clause. So that is like a cool way to be like, to know whether or not all of your tests, like let's say you don't have any tests written, the modern tools that we have today will tell you, you know, whether or not you're at least hitting like all of the lines of code, which is a little segue or a little digression, but we have the tools.
No, I think it's a good point to make about, like, it's not that painful with how much is out there and how easy this can be. I mean, there's things that are just totally more code agnostic, like Cypress, which does a full front-end testing, which can kind of do your back-end testing at the same time. But yeah, so there's probably tons of vendors like this Coveralls vendor that does a lot of this, like, team test coverage management. But there's also a ton of open source projects around. You don't have to pay for anything. And so, for example, Simple Cove and RubyLand and RailsLand gives you the exact same thing, including like a little web interface to all your test coverage, and it will show you, highlight the stuff that's not covered and is covered. And, you know, that makes it so you can also focus your test coverage where you're doing a refactor. So this can be a little bit of a process. You don't need 80% test coverage or 90% test coverage on your whole code base necessarily. If you have your golden path covered and then better coverage in the deeper parts of refactoring, that could be a good compromise for now, as you continuously move to that better code coverage. Yeah, absolutely. And so really this whole process of knowing when you need to refactor, writing the test to refactor, making your small changes is all for the end goal of, and this is how he kind of defines the end goal here, is a lot of small, well-named functions and methods that tell a clear story. And so instead of this big spaghetti line of code that's hard to follow with a lot of temp variables and things like that, you have this, he called it a nesting of functions, well-named functions. And so the idea here is that you can just kind of follow the well-named functions. If you're in a different language, maybe methods, depending on what you're writing, but you can just follow those functions all the way down and kind of read the story of what's going on here. So it's like, okay, get user data, perform action on user data, render user data. Oh, I understand what all these things are doing. And really it comes down to naming and breaking it up into smaller pieces, which is, again, the theme of this podcast always, which is break it into smaller pieces.
Yeah, I want to go through an example of just how directly applicable this is to like my day to day, which I think is really cool, because oftentimes, you know, we might go through these like higher level concepts and I'm thinking like, when am I ever going to really use duck typing?
Sure.
Like, am I going to use duck typing tomorrow? Maybe, maybe not. But like these refactoring skills are definitely something that you can practice on a day to day basis if you're coding every day. And so the example I want to walk through is there's this component that is a multi-slider in the Opendoor app. And when I say multi-slider, if you can imagine those, describing UI is probably just as hard as describing code, but it's those.
I mean, a slider is a standard UI component, which okay. is like a line with a dot, and yes. you slide the dot on the line different directions to set the value differently.
Yes. Now imagine if there were two dots. So instead of having a single value, you can have a range of values. And I think that's
On the same line. So a multi-slider. Yes. Oh, okay. So on a single line, there's two dots. And as you drag them, you're setting like a range. I know specifically Airbnb has a price selector like that. So it's like, show me, you know, stuff greater than $50, less than $300. And you kind of slide that slider on one line back and forth to set that range in that slider.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's one of our use cases. Another use cases is, oh, hey, I want to book a tour and I'm available from, and you could slide and say not 8 a.m., I'm available from 10 a.m. And then you could set the upper limit to say I'm available all the way up until 3:30 p.m.
So like that, a windowing type of idea within the ranges.
Exactly, yes. And so we have this component, and in order for us to ship, we had to bring in this library that was super slow, kind of buggy, the interactions weren't that great, and it just was like something that we had to, we came to a crossroads and we were like, well, we can either rebuild it and maybe not meet our like ship deadline that we want to meet, or we can just like ship this thing and it's like, it's usable, you know, like users can, it's not terrible, it's still usable, but it's not the best. And so I've spent the last like week or so refactoring this thing, and it was a nightmare. It was almost, in some ways, it felt like the first code example, where it was just like this huge function that was doing a bunch of different things. And since it's open source, there's like a bunch of different use cases for the slider. So like for the slider that we brought in, it was like, oh, you have the options to make it like a vertical slider, and you have options to make it a multi-slider, and you have options to make it a single slider. So now for us, it was like, you know, we don't need some of those options. So initially, we could take a bunch of cruft out. So this is one of those scenarios where I like literally jumped into the source code of the open source project and started like I copied and pasted that into my own file and started refactoring it. And what was really hard was that there were like three or four crucial helper functions that were deciding a lot of like the logic of how this thing should work. And the problem was that none of those had tests. And the second problem to that was that I had no idea what the fuck they were doing because all the variables were named terribly. And it had like, it gave me no indication of what these things should be doing. So what I had to do was I had to basically reverse engineer all of those things, comment things out, and understand what these variables should be named, at least in my head. And then from there, I was like, okay, so let me write some golden path tests just so that when I refactor this thing and rename these variables, I can be sure that it's at least still doing the same thing that it was doing previously. So I wrote some tests, I like renamed some variables, and I was like, okay, so now I can like start deleting things. So once I was able to like get some tests in place, I was able to start like actually refactoring this thing. And it was like I had my test suite up in like one window and I had like my code in the other window. And then in another space, I had like my mobile app simulator just to like also be sure that like this interaction was still working. And it was just like a tight feedback loop of make a small change, see that it still works, see that the test suite still works. And it was like the same process over and over and over again until I finally got something that was like, okay, these variables are named better. I can like step through the code. I can be sure that it's still doing what it initially did. And then from there, I was like able to get it through code review, get some feedback, and then make even more improvements from there. But like, I just think that it was super, super necessary to make those small gradual changes. And constantly, I think what was really important too was making sure that it still worked, right? Because like you have it in your head that like you want to get from point A to point B. And sometimes I think it's really easy to fall into the trap of not checking that it's working while you're in the process of making changes. So you're like, oh, okay, I made it to point B. And then like you refresh your simulator or refresh your web page or rerun your test suite and like things are broken and you just don't know why. So I think you could avoid that by all these like really, really small continuous steps.
Totally. I think it perfectly illustrates what we're talking through, especially the idea of your tests allowing you to be more confident in your change without having to constantly be QAing this thing. And I think especially in React Native, because there's that little bit of compile pipeline time to like recheck the app, that it would be so tedious. And like this change could have taken you dozens of hours longer just for that like compile and check process to manually QA this shit. So it makes a ton of sense to me to have that little bit of golden path and start refactoring that. The one point you made about, you know, getting the variable name something that made sense in your head and getting that into the code and continuously doing that is, that was one of the points that Martin Fowler made, which is refactoring is a process that lets you get things out of your head and into the code. And you continuously do this to get more of what's in your head into the code really eloquently and well said and well named. And I feel like probably after doing that open source refactor and extending the slider function and component, I feel like whoever jumps into that next will probably be able to follow your logic better because it's specific to your domain and you took the time to implement it and get rid of the things that aren't specific to your domain and really come up with good names for it. I'm sure the open source project did well in doing that initially for its purpose, but it was a more general purpose and your refactor took that from a general purpose to a specific one and all of that specific implementation is now out of your head and into the code, which is a huge win for your guys' code base.
Yeah, I should totally open source my refactored version of this thing. And one thing that I want to say was also really difficult was that there was no like documentation on what these functions were doing or like why these functions existed. So in my refactor, my functions are like heavily commented where I think things are non-obvious to like anyone jumping into it. And not only that, because it's like a UI interaction, I have some sweet, sweet ASCII art that like diagrams exactly like...
No way! So yes. In your code comments, you've got some ASCII?
Yeah,
I think that's important because UI, like UI components like that are really hard to name. It's like, what do you call the dot on the slider that is like the low value dot, the high value dot that like specifies those ranges? Like, it's so hard to name that stuff in a way that makes sense because people call all those different types of things different things. And it's really hard to put in just a little bit of code, a good name that encapsulates what that is. It's like, okay, tab container, tab content. It's like, what is, it's really hard to do that well. So that makes sense that you've got some ASCII heart. That's cool. I love that. So the last consideration about refactoring that Martin talks about is performance and refactoring. And a big thing he talks about is like, oh, you know, a lot of people are going to be like, hey, this refactor you're doing is going to impact your performance and it's going to be slower. So don't do that. And at the same time, he just makes the argument of, it's easier to improve the performance of Eloquent code than it is to improve the performance of nasty rat's nest code, regardless of whether the nasty rat's nest code is actually more performant day one after your refactor. And then the other point he makes, which is really interesting, is most developers are really bad about understanding performance and understanding how the change you're making impacts performance. So he's like, most of the time you feel like it's going to be so much worse to run this in four methods versus a single method. And at the end of the day, it makes no perceptible difference in your project at all. And it's way more readable broken up into four methods. Because I feel that way sometimes in Ruby, like breaking up a single method into five methods that all, you know, the single method calls those different five methods. It's like, yeah, well, it makes it a lot more clear, but at the same time, like it's passing more messages to more places. So isn't this going to impact my performance? So the bottom line that he basically says is just like, fuck it. Don't worry about your performance. You know, focus on the refactor first, and then you can always, you know, clean up your performance on the back end. It's going to be easier after the refactor. How do you feel about that, JP? Would you agree, disagree? Where do you land on that?
Yeah, I think he takes a very pragmatic approach because, you know, maybe I'm guilty of this too sometimes, is that like you look through a code review and then you see someone like make some change and you're like, oh, you know, that's like bad for performance. But then at the end of the day, it's like, really, is it? You know, I think a lot of the performance benefits that you can gain are probably like, You might need to take like a harder look at how you're doing a database call, for example, versus right. like how if you happen to be doing like a nested loop inside of your UI, you know, like it probably isn't that nested loop, or maybe it is, right. but the goal, and maybe you need that nested loop for clarity, who knows? But sort of the point is that unless you can like benchmark it and see that your change is like truly, truly slowing things down, you should maybe favor refactoring over like nitpicking. I think he's talking more about like nitpicking over this is gonna like be like, you know, 100 milliseconds slower. It's like, maybe it is, maybe it's not. Like, you don't actually know that. Like, you don't know how the computer is gonna digest this information.
Yeah, and I think a big part of what he's saying is, you know, trying to avoid all excuses to refactor, because it's like a lot of your excuses could be like, well, it's fine. Another excuse could be like, well, this is more performant, so I don't want something that's more explicit because it's going to be slower. Mm-hmm. He's trying to reduce any friction to anyone going into a refactor. And I think that he's right that don't try to think about performance too deeply while you're doing your refactor. Focus on the test still passing and the code being very readable, because it makes a lot more sense to me that you can actually dissect the performance a lot easier. Like, I'm just thinking about like AppSignal or different other types of error or performance monitoring systems. They'll tell you the exact methods that are slowing down your performance. And so it's a lot easier to be able to see that broken down smaller, because if you have a big long function, it might not be that function. It might just be one little action you're doing within that function that's slowing you down. So if it's broken down, it'll be a lot easier to find and diagnose and fix those problems. And then you can write just a test for that one function and then really dig into that specific function's performance and improve its performance after the refactor has been done. But I've been finding more and more that focusing on performance, at least in my world, too heavily before deploy, it's a false positive anyway. And ultimately, page loads, the worst case, we're going to page load that's like almost a second, which is terribly slow, and I don't want that in production, but we're going to catch it in our actual AppSignal environment. We're going to catch it in our performance handling and monitoring, and then we're going to address it and fix it. And so it's like worrying about that too much right now. You don't even know what your production data is necessarily. Ideally, your test environment is a perfect mirror of it, but it isn't always. And that's the reality. And there's other considerations to consider, like one being that your production server that's running on AWS is probably of a hell of a lot faster than your MacBook. So it might not have any issue with the specific types of methods and functions that you're running locally or in your test environment versus the actual performance environment. So I've found more and more that as long as your tests are passing and you're not making any any like terrible N plus ones or terrible mistakes like that. Like I've written some horribly performing apps where page loads are like 10 seconds. So this is years ago. I'm a new man, I promise. But you know, even in that case though, where there's this horribly performing thing, it was the case that production data was very different than our test environment. And that's what was causing that crazy performance hit. And it was really easy to diagnose and fix in production. And just like DHA says this all the time, and I think it's true, that servers aren't expensive anymore. So the upfront investment of the extra programmer's time of trying to like go way too deep and nitpick performance doesn't make sense. Like just throw more dinos at it. Like drag the Heroku slider up. Like that's fine for now, depending on your scale. You might work at, you know, crazy hundreds of thousands of users scale and you need to think about performance and nitpick it. And that might be your job. And I totally respect that. But in my world, like that's not what I'm worried about. I'm not worried about 1 or 2 milliseconds. It makes no impact on my bottom line or day to day.
Yeah, totally. And one thing I wanted to point out that I really liked what you said was that like we totally do have the tools to know where a bottleneck is, you know, like things like, oh man, how why is my method taking so long? Dude, you like just check your CD or whatever it is, like your CI/CD yeah. thing, and it will tell yeah. you like, hey, here's this highlighted line of code. It's highlighted in red. Fix this. Yeah. Whereas maybe in the past, like we didn't have those kinds of tools. So like you'll know if your refactor is like maybe not doing so hot based on like the tools that we have today.
Yeah. And I think splitting up your functions into smaller functions lets you do that even clearer. Like it'll show you exactly what function it is and it lets you test it and break it down and fix it even easier. So that's kind of an overview of the refactoring process and how we jump into them. And how Martin Fowler, how he recommends to jump into your refactors. And so I'm really excited because next week we're going to go through the specific code example in this chapter and walk through some specific refactors. So it's like, now we know the process, let's actually do a couple refactors at a high level together, but lower level than we did this week. So that's going to be next week. So it's kind of chapter one, the technical side of chapter one next week. So I'm really excited to get into that. So with that, let's jump into some picks. Do you have a pick, JP?
Yeah, totally do. This week is, surprise, surprise, another book, but it is like code related. So the book is called, it's actually recommended to me by my boss. It's called Creative Selection, Inside Apple's Design Process During the Golden Age of Steve Jobs. And it's like written by this guy who is a former principal engineer at Apple during like the golden age of Steve Jobs. So like when they were making like the iPods and the iPhones. And I don't want to butcher his last name, but it's Ken Cochinetta. I don't know. Jeez, I probably like butchered the hell out of that. But look it up. It's called Creative Selection. It's a good like nighttime read. And it like gives like a little bit of insight into Apple's process, which I think is super cool. And it's like a dude who was like a former engineer there. So that's also cool because I feel like I'm an engineer. He's an engineer. You know, we have some things in common.
That sounds really cool, especially the golden age of Steve Jobs. Like I love hearing about like the secret Apple design meetings, like that one story of when he threw the iPod into the fish tank.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so fucking cool. I have to tell that story real quick if you haven't heard it. Someone brings him one of the first versions of the iPod and he's like, hey, make it smaller. And they're like, we can't. And he throws it into the fish tank in his office and bubbles come out. And he's like, there's fucking air in it. You can make it smaller. Get rid of the air. It's just so cool. It's like also terrible, but it's also amazing at the same time. Yeah. Cool. Great pick. I have to check that one out. I love when there's books on design that aren't necessarily code or technical design, but it seems like that also talks about a high level like product design and just like the whole product and design process in general. Yep. And that's super cool. Awesome. I've got two podcasts in my pick, so I'm going to pick a couple podcasts real quick. Of course, there's Syntax, which is that doesn't even count as a pick because I feel like you all probably listen to that, which is Wes Boss and Scott Talinsky's podcast, which is totally awesome. They do it twice weekly now, so if you don't listen to that one, you should probably get in on that one. A couple other ones here. Darknet Diaries is super nerdy and super cool. It's this info security expert who breaks down like these like crazy exploit stories, and it makes me super paranoid as a developer that people are going to hack my shit. But I've learned a ton about information security and just like through that really dark side of white hat, black hat hacking and stuff like that. The Stuxnet one was mind blowing. It's such interesting shit. The last one I'll mention here is How to Code Well. I've been listening to a few episodes lately, and it's just a good, solid code podcast. The episodes are short, and he covers a lot of different topics. So yeah, I would totally recommend that one as well. So there's just a couple random, more technical and nerdy podcasts. I feel like Reply All, there's like a ton of great podcasts. I'm a huge podcast guy, but yeah.
Super cool. I'll have to give those a listen. They sound interesting. My interest is piqued.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for listening, guys, and we will see you next week.
Peace.